Thank you. Thank you and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ken Owen. I'm Executive Director of Media Relations here at DePauw. Oh, thank you, Michelle. And I'm here tonight to perform my comedy routine. I'm also a 1982 graduate of the university, and we're thrilled to have you here tonight for the Timothy and Sharon Ubben Lecture Series. Tim and Sharon are 1958 graduates of DePauw, and back in 1986, they gave the university money with the express purpose that we bring in incredible visitors, bring the world to Greencastle, as it were. And in the intervening years, we've had people like Margaret Thatcher here, Colin Powell, Barbara Bush, Tony Blair was here a year ago, and tonight we have Todd Rundgren, which is a real special treat. Todd will be out in a matter of minutes. We're going to cut the house lights. I put together a little video for the four or five people out there that may not be quite as familiar with Todd's work as others. It will take you from the very beginnings to today, and then we'll welcome Todd to DePauw University. So direct your attention to the screen, and the program is underway.
Now, we'd like to introduce once again the multi-talented Todd Rundgren.
In this next song, Todd is going to sing live to a pre-recorded track.
And that includes playing the sax, the drums, the bass,
He does it all by himself.
I told you he could do it all.
Here he is, Todd Rundgren.
The album was recorded with just two instruments, Todd Rundgren's voice, and a sophisticated digital sampling device called the emulator.
The manner in which I use this on the album goes something like this. Get a microphone, put it into sample mode. Ooh. Put a sample of sound in it, that's what it looks like. You picture it, and then you can play the sampled sound. This is where I sampled it at. Ooh, ooh. So you get some idea what it sounds like. What you you hear is my voice digitally encoded into bits and bytes and stored inside the instrument. And it will now play it anywhere on the keyboard that I place my hand. Simple as pie.
Dear God, hope you got the letter, and I pray you can make it better down here.
I'm an adult now.
Todd Rundgren, this gentleman has been making popular and influential music since the late 1960s. Right here is his first solo album in 4 years. It's entitled Nearly Human.
People usually gather to hear this man sing and play guitar. More than 300 crammed into a Chicago record store to see Todd Rundgren demonstrate something you have to see to believe. Interactive music.
Ever listened to the album and decided that you wanted to hear the lyrics a little better, or maybe that you didn't want to hear the lyrics at all? You now have control over that.
The listener is provided with almost 3 hours of music broken down into 933 fragments. With the system, you take those little musical pieces and create something all your own. Or you can let the machine reinvent the music for you.
It's alright, I'm okay, I think I can explain.
Wake up the new America, oh, oh, oh.
What puts tonight's show as good as it is, what puts this show over the top, I got it for you, sitting in with the band tonight, is a pop music legend who's in town performing with Ringo Starr's all-star band. He's sitting 3 feet away from me, Todd Rundgren. Give him a hand. Todd? This is very cool. I used to think when I was a kid, maybe someday I'll get to someday do a TV show where I stand there and tell jokes. I never thought 3 feet away, Todd Rundgren sitting there, wearing the coolest sunglasses I've seen in my entire life.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to DePaul University's Oven Lecture Series, Todd Rundgren. Todd, good to see you.
Give it up high.
You have friends.
Well, thank God for that Letterman guy. You know? Nobody would know who I was otherwise.
I promise not to be James Lipton tonight, so if I am, somebody throw an ice cube right about. We might want to move our mics up just a little bit, Todd.
Hello? Hello? Mike,
move yours up a little bit.
Is this on?
Let's begin at the beginning. Growing up in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, I feel like we're like a mile apart here. We can scoot in a little bit and kill a couple of plants. It was a musical household. Obviously, was it a dream when you were a kid to be a musician, or did it just kind of come upon you? And when did technology kind of begin to be a curiosity for you?
Well, the house was musical only in as much as my parents were music fans, but neither one was a musician. They enjoyed a little robust caroling every once in a while. They liked to sing in the car and harmonize. Music that, well, I vaguely remember it now, but it's, you know, kind of like the novelty tunes of the of the big band era. But they could sing in harmony. It was kind of like Lucy and Ricky, I guess. But my dad was very much into music and had a very eclectic, or somewhat eclectic, taste in music. And so I was exposed to styles that probably a lot of people were not exposed to. He was very much into contemporary classical music as well as maybe some older stuff, but he was anything from like Ravel on or Debussy on, he was pretty much into a lot of show tunes, things like that. The technological aspect came into it, I believe, fairly early because he built his own hi-fi from a probably from some plans in a popular electronics magazine. And I remember distinctly it was a green cube about this big with a black grill cloth and a turntable sat on top, and I believe the electronics were built into the box. And I was never allowed to touch it. Only government-sanctioned music would ever be played on that hi-fi. But we used to go with regularity to my grandmother's house, my father's mom, and she had a piano in the attic, an old spinet. And I used to go up there for hours and just bang on it and think I was, you know, improvising the most wonderful music, probably just drowning out the rest of my life. That's what it was at that point. And just time would pass without me having any idea exactly how long it had been, but the experience of making the music, or what appeared to me to be music on the piano, kind of, I guess, primed me for the idea of eventually playing an instrument. And I went through several instruments in the early days. Believe it or not, when I was growing up, they had music programs in elementary school.
Amazing.
And any student who wanted to participate could very cheaply rent an instrument. And the first instrument that I thought I wanted to play was flute, but I never did get the embouchure exactly right. And also the fingering was obtuse to me. That I couldn't figure out the fact that it wasn't linear. And so I moved on to other instruments. So I remember my sister decided that she might play the clarinet, but she wasn't good at it and hardly touched it. And I learned how to play like a Mr. Akerbilk song on it, which pleased my dad immensely. I think it was Two Strangers on the Shore. But I had this aptitude for picking up melodies and figuring out how to play them on the instrument. But my experience with the guitar was kind of, I don't know, perhaps it was delayed a bit because my dad had a guitar that he bought when he was in the service that he never played. It sat in the basement gathering dust, but I knew it was there, and I used to go down every once in a while and muck around with it a little bit. And one day I thought I would get serious and try and tune it. And I had a tuning in my head. I didn't know how to tune a guitar, what the notes were supposed to be, but I had one in my head, and my little fingers couldn't turn the machines enough, you know, to get the string to where I wanted it, so I took a pair of pliers and turned it until the neck snapped off the guitar. And that didn't go over very well, but I believe I made it known to my parents in affirmative terms that I wanted to play the guitar, and eventually they got me guitar lessons at the local music store.
And how old were you at that point?
I was probably at eight at mm-hmm. the time, something like that.
And about what time did you get interested in robots and things that move?
Oh, I was always into robots. You know, the robots were, I can't say I was always into robots. I was into robots from Forbidden Planet on. That was when Robbie the Robot first appeared. And he was the friendly robot. You know, all robots before that were like killer robots. But Robbie was the friendly robot who would mix drinks for you and things like that. And I remember going with my parents to the movie theater because they had a big promotion. You could get coupons on the back of Quaker Oats boxes, you know, the round box that they used to have those. And so I remember at least some of the children got in with Quaker Oats free passes. In any case, the movie, a lot of it scared me, but the Robbie the Robot part was really cool. And being a lonely child, I thought what I needed was a robot friend for companionship and protection. And so from that point on, I always had in my mind that I wanted to build a robot, and certainly did enough drawings on paper and collected enough junk over the years to possibly build several robots. But the stumbling block was that no matter how you hooked all this stuff up, the robot had no volition or movement or anything unless it had a brain of some kind. And I guess when I was about 11, I started studying binary logic, because this was the basis of computers. Essentially, one very simple operation, yes or no, compounded into many decisions and arrays of decisions that would look like the computer was doing something really brilliant, when all it was doing was deciding yes or no, yes or no, yes or no. The advantage to having at least some passing understanding of this and the associated number system, the binary number system, which is just ones and zeros, gave me a big leg up when I got to high school in an algebra class when they started to introduce the new math and doing mathematical operations in number systems besides 10. And I was able to breeze through that, mystified everyone, including my teacher. What further mystified them is I had no interest in any of the other work, and so failed every other aspect of the class. but I was able to do do any kind of number system, math in any number system. Mm-hmm. So when I was in high school, I had two options. I had already gotten into a band, and I was playing electric guitar by then, and had some aptitude at it, and I was terrible at school. I had no grades. My parents had no money. It didn't look like I was going to be able to go to college, but if I went to any kind of school, I might have gone to a technical school to learn how to program computers or get in a band. And fortunately, I got into a band because I didn't have the money to go to technical school, and computers in those days are really boring.
Well, let's talk about a band, the band that most people relate to you as early in the career. You were in Woody's Truck Stop before that, but the Nazz, and we saw the video a little bit ago. Most, it seems to me, young musicians today get into a band thinking they want to be a rock star. I mean, a rock star is a glorified thing, as it was then, but in a different way.
It's a good enough reason.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there were those kinds of reasons for you, too. But I heard you talking to the students. We had a barbecue with Todd over at our nature park, and you were talking about really how you kind of didn't want to sing. I mean, you were a backup singer. You weren't somebody who wanted to be out front early on.
I believe I was trying to make a distinction between the performer and the musician, and the fact that I always knew that I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to play an instrument. I wanted to be involved in musical productions. I wasn't so sure I wanted to write yet, but the only extracurricular activity I had all through high school was chorus, which was the one that you had to get up really early in the morning for. It was unfair, but I enjoyed singing in the chorus, being part of the chorus, never imagined to be being a soloist, and I thought of myself at the age of 16 or 15 as being a baritone, which I can handle now, but which then I didn't really have the downward range to cover, and yeah, that was pretty much it. The only musical thing I did that had anything to do with the establishment was being in the chorus. I didn't go to music school. I didn't get any sort of those guitar lessons I mentioned before. I got through about 2 months of them, the minimum that you needed in order to pay for the cheap Korean guitar. and then quit and just started picking up everything by ear.
Okay, so you're in the Nazz, and if you can just explain in a nutshell what that was like. That was a kind of a hyped, semi-manufactured situation. I mean, you guys.
Yeah,
were
well,
on the cover
even
of
then,
magazines.
You know, we thought that maybe somewhere down the line, you know, getting a record deal or something like that, and international notoriety, wouldn't that be great? That was something in the distant future. The first problem was, you know, how do we wow the people in the neighborhood? So after like 9 months of being in Woody's truck stop, and they all decided to take acid and go to the country and get their heads together, I decided that wasn't for me. I wanted to do a little more hardcore thing with a British influence, so I put together the Nazz that was sort of modeled after The Who, a little Beatles and a little Beach Boys, and some Yardbirds as well, but heavy on the jamming and arm flailing and things like that, real showbiz. And we had no material yet. I had yet to write a song ever. Had to realize I had to write some songs, wrote a bunch of guitar songs so we could, you know, flail around. And then I accidentally wrote Hello, It's Me during that period, and it wound up on the first Nazz record. Ironically enough, I had quit the band by the time that became a hit record. And so we didn't actually go out and promote it or anything like that. It was an accident. It was actually the B-side of our first single. And it got flipped and got some radio airplay, and that was the first kind of musical success we experienced. But starting out with the Nazz, no, the objectives were not to immediately become stars. All we had to do was conquer our neighborhood, and we would have all the sex and the other accoutrements that we could possibly want. Truth be told, probably the only reason why I defied my my high school for so long and insisted on having my hair grown out was a conviction that if I looked anything like a Beatle, I would eventually get chased down the street by girls. Because nothing else seemed to be working very well for me. So I said, grow your hair, no brainer.
So the Nazz blows up. I mean, you walk away from the Nazz. What led to
that? Well, the interpersonal conflicts, the fact that everyone imagined, for instance, that the Beatles was some sort of democratic thing. They never said, or at least, you know, from the Beatles standpoint or whoever was doing publicity for the Beatles, they never said, this guy is more important than this guy or more integral than this guy. They're all like equal, and the movies put, you know, kind of promulgated the same sort of myth that they all, it was just a happy-go-lucky romp, and all the four of them had to do was whatever came naturally, and success followed. And then we discovered, like a mere 3-4 years later, that there's that it's infighting and wife swapping and acrimony, and the two principal songwriters don't even show up in the same room together, even though it still says Lennon McCartney. You know, they never sit down and write songs together. It turns out to be more the reality of what a band is, which is some sort of entente or something like that, some sort of mutual agreement, you know, not to explode before a certain precise moment. And then at that moment, everything goes to hell. And so it was pretty much that with the Nazz. You know, we were a bunch of, well, me and Carson Van Austin, we had shared a room together for a long time, so we got along pretty well. But the other two guys, we didn't know well, and as time went on, you know, you either become better friends or better enemies. And a lot of that evolved, and then eventually the band broke up over things that had probably less to do with music than they did with interpersonal dynamics.
Okay. And I want to keep moving because we got 42 years to cover, and I want to get questions from the audience.
Certainly. I know, I, you know. You
no, don't these are great stories, and I think everybody
I'll tell
agrees.
Everything I know.
And I feel bad. I feel bad cutting you off because I'm enjoying this thoroughly. So you leave the Nazz, and I think the thing a lot of people overlook is that you're essentially not a performing musician at this point. You become an engineer. You take on another trade of sorts.
Well, yeah, part of the problem was that I was not ready to step up and be the front man of anything after the Nazz left. So the alternative for me, in order to stay involved with music and do something that I liked that had to do with the music business, was to move into the control room, essentially, and produce records for other people. And in the process, I picked up engineering as well, which turned out to be another marketable skill. But more importantly, it was a great asset in terms of production, because I was able to cut out the middleman in terms of sound. Often producers to be a producer can involve a lot of different aspects. The very first producer I ever had any studio experience with was really old school, in that a producer had no or hardly any creative input. He just made sure that the session didn't run over, because he was more in charge of the budget than he was in charge of any sort of real quality control. That was usually be up to the arranger, and the engineer was in charge of the sound quality. So when I became a producer, it was an asset to be able to engineer and to be able to visualize what a record should sound like and not have to go through, you know, all the tortures of hell to get it to sound that way. That is not to diminish the importance of having at least some musical sensibility. And there are producers whose musical sensibility is completely inarticulate. They just said, I like that. That'll be a hit, you know, or I hate that. That won't be a hit. And that's, for some, that's all it takes, you know. Mm-hmm. But my career as a producer has been to kind of like nurse people along. I don't often work with people who are already successful and satisfied. There's either a new artist who has very little or no experience of the studio, or an artist who's hit some sort of cul-de-sac in terms of their record making, and I have to shake them up a little bit to break them out of it. So when I first became a producer, I was strong on the kind of sound aspects and musical aspects, very weak on the sociological and psychiatric aspects. thinking that if I was a producer, I would get out all that strife that comes with being in a band. No, I inherit the band's strife when they walk into the studio. And, you know, I have to break people up sometimes and resolve issues musically and sometimes non-musically. Sometimes you have to be the prick so that everyone else can focus on you being the prick and not on each other being the little pricks. And so
we're going to talk about individual productions in a bit, but so Albert Grossman, essentially, you're engineering for Bearsville. And
when I became a producer, yeah, it was in the Albert Grossman organization.
Right, who was Bob Dylan's manager and your manager for a while and many other people. And was it a favor, kind of a side project where he said, you know, you can make a record if you want?
No, I asked if I could make a record.
Okay.
I guess he said, oh, you can if you want, but they actually gave me a budget to do it because mm-hmm. I didn't do it in... Well, there was no Bearsville studio yet when I did my first album. Even though I've been producing, it's not as if I stopped being a musician. I was still writing songs and I had musical ideas and liked to make records and wanted to have my own musical ideas on record. So I asked for a budget and they said, okay. And since I wasn't hiring a lot of musicians, I had like a rhythm section, just bass and drums. Well, there were a lot of different sessions, but a lot of those sessions were people that I had worked with before, and they contributed their performances, so I didn't have to pay, for instance, Levon Helm and Rick Danko to play on my record. And it was, it was known to everyone in the label. It was a vanity project. It was just something to keep me satisfied. But they were a bit taken aback when I delivered the record and they heard like this whole range of sort of musical ideas and also a song that they thought could be a hit single, which they then released and which then became a hit single up to a point.
We Gotta Get You a Woman.
It was called We Gotta Get You a Woman.
I did a James Lipton there, by the way. Sorry.
The what's that?
I was a James Lipton moment.
That was a James Lipton moment, yes. Okay. And it started to take off as a single, but this was at the same time that there was a militant feminist movement happening. And some in that movement decided to misinterpret the lyrics to their favor and implied or impugned that I was saying something about women in general, about them being stupid.
But they sure are fun.
Which, if you can parse a sentence, is not what I'm saying, you know. I'm saying like little things that may be trivial, you know, but seem to mean so much to you, you know, little things about somebody. And And they started threatening to bomb radio stations to play the record. Things like that. It got to be a whole burlesque. So it never got to actually probably the point it would have gotten to. That was just as well, because even my first attempts at fronting a band in order to perform behind this single were painful at best. They were painful and painful and embarrassing at worst, because I had never fronted a band. I had never attempted to sing my own material live, and I had never attempted to do a whole show of material, which in those days, you know, a set was 40 minutes. You know, a headliner would play for 40 minutes, and maybe twice a night. And I couldn't make the 40 minutes. I couldn't, before I would have my voice blown out and I'd be completely exhausted. And that was the point at which I realized the vast difference between a musician and a performer. And that you don't have to be both, but if you are going to be both, you have to take them equally seriously. And it took me years to build up the stamina and confidence to actually be able to get out onto the stage with some certitude that I can get through the show without losing my voice or collapsing from exhaustion or something. So,
and look at you now.
I mean, what's that?
Look at you now. 2 hours
and
of arena rock.
Look at me
rock.
Now.
Yeah, it's an amazing show if you haven't seen it. We're going to fast forward to Something Anything, which is behind us. And I want to have an image come up that appeared in the video we showed a moment ago before you came out. Mm-hmm. The Midnight Special in 1973. And it's a moment many, many people who were watching that show and are fans of yours today remember. If we can see that image, Dwayne Scoob, who's done a great job upstairs, that is a famous image, a Lynn Goldsmith photograph.
Yeah.
But, you know, to some people, cynics, it's a jump the shark moment. I mean, it's like Todd Rundgren is the next rock messiah, the press was saying. Todd Rundgren was probably on track to be the next Elton John, even though you were probably bigger than Elton John at that moment. I don't mean that. Don't take that personally the wrong way.
The next pudgy, balding, gay piano player.
From Mojo in 1998, whether or not this was the moment at which Todd Rundgren's career came crashing down, it was certainly symbolic of the man's refusal to march to any beat but his own. And I mean, I'm curious, and I think it's great, but you're backstage in the Midnight Special, and this makeup is being applied by Nikki Nichols, right?
No, I had no idea what he was going to do with me.
Okay, really?
No, I had a costumer and makeup guy who traveled with us and would... You know, he would do makeup every night, carried like a sewing machine and a Marrow machine with him, and would, if he got inspired to, just come up with new costumes, mm-hmm. which I would wear, most of which would be, you know, fulfilling some homoerotic fantasy of his. And I'd say, oh, what the hell, I'll put it on, you know. And in this particular instance, you know, he says, well, I got these feathers, you know, and he made this, he showed me the vest. I thought, that's pretty cool with the, you know, it's got a very Asian looking thing with the feathers turning up there in the medallion, fine. And he starts putting the makeup on, and I, you know, I don't know what exactly is going on, but I think, ooh, that's pretty wild. But the coup de grace, as it were, and the thing that really kind of, the part that I wasn't going for, was he got out the, you know, the hot curler and gave me something of a Mary Tyler Moore flip at the end, you know, and I thought that's not, you know, that isn't quite right. So,
but
but in any case, you know, it's like, what the hell, you know, you're in for a penny, in for a pound, more or less. You know, it's a Midnight Special. You want to come off like Billy Squire, or you want to come off like the real Billy Squire?
You know? You could point to that moment and say that that was your first twist. I mean, you know, from an audience standpoint, you were kind of on a track. You were a singer-songwriter.
Well, you have to say, though, but this particular moment here, you would have to put into context. You have to realize that David Bowie is filleting Mick Ronson's guitar at the same time somewhere, you know. And wearing a skin-tight, you know, spandex suit, mm-hmm. and as we all are wont to do, you know. And you know, this was around the glam, still around the glam era, you know, so this sort of cross-dressing is not unusual at all. But to take it to this degree probably was a little unusual. Yeah.
I think especially given audience kind of expectation of what you might be, because I think this was to many people their first exposure to a visual representation mm-hmm. of Todd Rundgren. So that sets the chapter, I think, for a discussion I want to get into about your musical adventures. What followed Something Anything is probably the thing that most people would have mm-hmm. guessed could never follow Something Anything. Something that was...
Or should never have followed Something.
Else. I think A Wizard, A True Star is probably viewed as your most adventurous and influential album in many ways.
It is amazing what time will do in context, because it was Something... Wizard, A True Star, after Something Anything, was considered a blatant act of career suicide. And the whole point is, you know, as I said before, a lot of these things are just vanity projects for me. I like to make music, I like to capture it and listen to it after I've done it, then I like to move on and do something else. And as I said, I had no expectations commercially from my first record, even though it did have a hit single on it. I had no specific expectations from my second record, which nobody remembers, which was The Ballad of Todd Rundgren. And that happened when there was
a great record.
But it meant something to me to kind of become more of a, you know, have more of a song stylist, you know, instead of just doing everything at once. I was able to sort of focus a little bit and pick out a kind of an instrumental range, you know, focus on the piano, bass, and drums, add some coloration and stuff like that, but tame it down a little bit and focus a little bit more on song structure. And that was a phase I needed to go through, but it wasn't the destination. By the time I got to Something Anything, I was getting formulaic. I saw the light, I wrote in 15 minutes. It was just like, you know, and it was done, you know, because I had just gotten into just, you know, that sort of song form that I developed on the previous album became habitual. And after I got done listening to Something Anything, and a lot of people don't or conveniently ignore the fact that there are precursors to A Wizard, A True Star in Something Anything. There are already experimental things going on that you couldn't categorize as songs per se, and there are little instrumental interludes and other things that are already starting to break up the formula. But by the time I got to A Wizard, A True Star, I was first of all trying not to fall into some sort of into that Elton John thing, mm-hmm. you know, of just like, here's another one, here's another, give me a bouncy C, you know. I want my material to at least mean something to me, and effort, you know, increases the value of things. Things that you don't put any effort into don't have any value. So just the effort of coming up with new directions, for me, re-evaluates what I'm trying to do. And not only was I trying to get away from those specific sort of habits of writing music, I was looking at the form factor that I was working in that I had never actually stood back and looked at. The album up to that point was just that. It was considered a collection of songs. You got enough of them, like photographs, you put them in an album, and that was it. But I thought, what if you look at the side of the record. Now we don't have sides, of course, but look at the side of the record as just completely blank canvas. And there is no such thing as a song form per se. If you want to make a song, go ahead and make a song. But if you got an idea that lasts 30 seconds, that's just as good as a song. If you get something that's just sound, an experiment with sound. And I started essentially trying to map the relative chaos in my head, all the different musical fragments and all the different directions that they might go into, onto this blank canvas. And it was the first time I had my own studio to do it, and I don't think I could have done the record unless I had built the studio first. So it was this whole coming together of a bunch of things. Me getting self-conscious about becoming a kind of a song stylist, not a musician. Musician is someone who is continually fascinated with music and continually learns new things to do with music. Mm-hmm. And the result was something that didn't resemble resemble hardly any record that had been out before that. It was, there were no spaces between the songs. I think something might start and then just stop and go right into some other thing. Music might be bifurcated into pieces, might go into some little nostalgic interlude and then go into some spacey synthesized other thing. You know, there were actually no rules about it. But what it did do was, more than any of my other records, reveal more accurately what my personality is actually like. What most people call rebelliousness, it doesn't have to be rebelliousness, it just has to be obstinance, that you see things a certain way and you're convinced that's the way that it's supposed to be. You're not against anything, you know. I'm not rebelling necessarily against anything except myself, except the things that I would do that I would later regret having done.
And while you're making these, I would say, more experimental records, Initiation, Utopia, mm-hmm. followed, and we're skipping over a lot of ground here, mm-hmm. You're still producing. In fact, these are days where you're producing 3-4 records a year sometimes.
Well, these are the salad days, yeah, when I would put out 2 solo records, 1 Utopia record, and 3 productions in 1 year. But that was, it only took 2 weeks to make a record in those days. That was before Bruce Springsteen would take a year to make a record.
And one of those records was, I guess, designed in your mind as a Bruce Springsteen parody. I want to play a clip of Meatloaf. Actually, it's mm-hmm. Jim Steinman, who wrote all the Meatloaf songs, and then Meatloaf himself. This is a video clip about Project Todd produced and played the lead guitar on.
Producers just hated it. We would go to producers and they'd say, it's impossible. You can't do this on a record. It's theater music, so no one's going to want to buy it. And it's also, you can't get it across on record. It depends on seeing this huge guy in front of you. You're pounding the piano. It's all visual. We can't get that on record. And the only person who believed in it was Todd Rundgren, who's either he believed in it or he just didn't care. Either way, he's a genius.
This is where Todd, in his one take on the lead guitar track, stopped it and said, oh, you want a motorcycle, huh? Okay, watch this. And he did a few knobs. Now I want to solo this and just listen to him do the motorcycle and come out. Okay, go ahead. Like a sinner. It's guitar. Never stops. Watch. He's going to come right on to a solo. Never stopped it. But you're standing here watching Todd do this. Mouth open, going, unbelievable.
Anyway.
That sounds awful without the rest of the track, doesn't it?
We're hearing the back bounce here. Did you know, I looked this up on Wikipedia, so it's got to be true.
Okay.
Of course. That is the number 9 album all time in terms of sales, and it sold 5 million more than number 10, which is Sgt. Pepper.
Whoa.
That's influential.
That's a big gap, I have to say. But
the Beatles
may
not catch
up. Number 9, but... But after a certain point, you can't tell about anything. There's the bootleg era, and then who knows how much anything sold. But that was a complete shock to every one of us, the success of that record. Nobody came into the record with those sort of expectations. In fact, we were sort of fortunate to get the thing done at all. It was, as Steinman mentioned, it was not the thing that people immediately said, oh, wow, I get it. And we started the record. He had a record label, and we went through about a week or so of rehearsals in preparation for the record. We were all up in Bearsville. I'm going to do it in the Bearsville studio. And Meatloaf suddenly got into his head one day that his label didn't understand him. This is when we're about to go into the studio and start the sessions. That his label didn't understand him, and he wanted off the label. So he called them up, and they said, gladly, you're off the label. Suddenly we're there with like eight musicians, and the studio ready to go, and nobody to pay for the record. And so I went to Bearsville, the powers that be at Bearsville, and I said, okay, if you bankroll this record, I'll give you the first crack at it. You know, otherwise you just put it on my tab until we find someone to distribute it. And we finished the record, and they passed on it. It was between Bearsville and Warner Brothers, who distributed Bearsville. They had to both agree to take on the artist, and one or the other, or both, I don't know, decided to pass on it. So for months, there was no label at all for the record. We didn't know whether the record would come out at all. And they finally found a little label called Cleveland International. It was distributed by Epic Records. And one guy, his name was Steve Popovich, and he had one other artist of any note. It was Ian Hunter, former lead singer of Monte Hoople, but an incredible artist in his own right, and a splendid gentleman. And see, this really is turning into...
Actor Studio.
Yeah, Actor Studio.
Well, let's get past Steve Meatloaf, because I don't want to dwell too long on that. Those stories are legendary and good.
Oh, the hell with Meatloaf.
The hell with Meatloaf. Let's talk about late 70s, you start really getting into computers. You get your own computer, and are you responsible for what eventually became the Paint Box?
I first got interested in video. I got interested in video because there were a couple of TV programs on, usually on public television in New York City, WNET in New York, very progressive. And they produced the original Sesame Street and also a show called Electric Company. And more than Sesame Street, but especially on Electric Company, they have these little bumps where they are supposed to teach very simple concepts to preschoolers, but in somewhat hipper way than usual, like mindless children's television used to be. And one of the things they had was a piece of technology called a Rudetra synthesizer, in which they could take the raster, that is old-fashioned TV talk, you know, doesn't apply to CRTs and stuff, but essentially, if you know anything about it, the picture is a light beam scanning across the surface, and what they would do is take magnets and electromagnets and distort it, and then they would be able to change the shapes of things and do things with really highly saturated colors. They were developing colorization boxes. They would take a black and white signal and turn it into something really vivid and colorful. And I got fascinated by all this abstract imagery that they were coming up with. And a lot of people were using this and other sorts of video devices. Developed a little scene in Lower Manhattan, and a lot of it produces video that they would show on public television. One program was called Videotape Review, VTR, and there was another one called The Egg or something like that. And it would be all experimental video. A lot of it would be music and abstract visuals and things like that, and I got very into that. I thought, this is a way to kind of like take the things that you imagine when you hear music and kind of create a visual to go along with it, kind of a Fantasia concept, the more abstract passages in Fantasia, like in the very beginning where it starts out with the orchestra and then it's just waveforms and colors and stuff splashing around. And I thought, this is a great way to enhance music. So I got interested in video, started investing in video equipment, and by the time it was the late 70s, I had a video studio as well and was making videos even before there was MTV. And what was the question?
We were talking about the Paint Box.
Oh, the Paint Box, yeah. So anyway, I had a video studio. I had one thing that we had was a fairly substantial investment in one of the first digital frame stores. In other words, TV was still analog. There was no such thing as digital TV except in the production aspects of it, in which they could convert the analog signal into a digital signal and put it in what they call a frame store, and then you could do processes on that you're very familiar with nowadays, but were very stunning in those days, where you could shrink a picture down and zoom it off in one corner, or something like that. So we bought one of the first devices that could do that. And there was a school called the New York Institute of Technology, which was one of the birthplaces of computer graphics. This is one of the most amazing technological sagas in all of humankind, in terms of the progress that has been made. They had one of the first kind of like computer graphic breakthroughs, which was they developed a way to take that frame store, that thing that could store a video image, and take a graphics tablet, which is a pen that interfaces with a flat surface just as a pen on paper does, and you draw on that and then your strokes are translated onto the screen. And so you could paint a picture without using essentially electronics, without using pencil or paper oil or anything. It was the first time such a thing had ever happened, that you could just paint directly into the video sphere. Fairly commonplace nowadays. But I wanted to use that. They wanted to use my digital effects box, so we traded some time, and I went down and worked with them on the paint box to do some things. I was so fascinated with the technology that when the Apple II computer came out, I wanted to get into graphics programming, not sound. I wanted to mess around with video and graphics, and found a one-of-a-kind thing that somebody had built, a graphics tablet, attached it up and started designing a paint box program that worked just like the one that I had seen. Of course, in a far lower resolution, nothing that would look too great on video, but it was just the concept, and it was a way for me to learn how to program the computer. And one time we were out in playing in San Francisco, and I thought, I'm going to go down to the Apple and show them what I've been working on. Apple was in one building then, one relatively small building in Cupertino. And as it turned out, at least one of the guys who worked there actually was from Philadelphia and knew who I was. So I came in and I showed them what I was working on. They said, well, if you finish that, we'll publish it. They had decided they were going to get into software publishing, which in those days they didn't stay in very long. They did a bad job of it. But essentially, I published this paint box program and became software designer, became part of my resume as a result of that. I didn't really get into using computers for musical purposes until like the late 80s.
And we're going to forward the tape again, if you don't mind. I'm going to forward the tape to and Dwayne, let's skip the next video. I want to go to 1990.
The time's flying by.
Yes, well, we're having a good talk. I just don't want to be here singing Christmas carols.
Yeah, well, my nose starts itching. I know I've been talking too much.
Uh-oh, well, you're doing a fine job. It was Christmas 1990, I think, that you made the Change Myself video. And I'm going to have Dwayne roll up behind us as we talk about it. You took a bunch of, was it Amiga computers?
Yeah. Well, here.
Actually, that's Jim Steinman. He never goes away.
That's them.
That's you. Yeah, and then we'll see the Change
that
Myself
That guy on
video.
The left, he still works for me.
Okay, anyway, we'll get it together. But the Change Myself video, which should be the third clip, we're going to skip beyond. Yeah. Anyway, I think just in a nutshell, you took these Amiga computers and put them together, and if we showed this today, a student would look at it and say, oh, you know, looks pretty cool. But back then, to take video, animation, have things bubbling and moving around and spinning, it was groundbreaking.
Well, I knew a little bit about what it took to get to make the leap into the 3D realm. You know, it's big difference between painting pixels into a 2D space and designing virtual objects that then have to be animated and rendered and all of this other stuff. And I knew a little bit about it and had an interest in it, but figured that it was probably technologically and financially out of reach for me. But I was a yearly attendee at the SIGGRAPH conferences, which, for those of you who don't know, this is the special interest group for graphics of the ACM, the American Computing Machinery, I think, or something, or I don't know what it stands for. But in any case, it's in those days, as in the Halcyon days and the early days of any of these new concepts, it's way fun to go to these things and see the leaps and bounds of technological evolution. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking around the floor, and there's all these the SGI boxes I can never afford, $100,000, $200,000, the other system I can't afford, all this other stuff. There's this one booth by a company called NewTek, where they've got like a couple of Amiga computers up there, and they're showing these spaceships flying around and shooting at each other, and literal quotations from Star Wars and stuff are re-rendered using what essentially was a card inside an Amiga. And I got totally fascinated, realizing first of all that this was affordable, so the first thing I did was buy one and start mucking around with it to see whether I could first of all learn the software, get it to do what I wanted to do, and then possibly produce something. So yeah, it was a bit before Christmas. I had the song already. It was Change Myself. And the people at the company were very kind of hip and go-go. The engineer who had actually designed the card that went into the Amiga, his name was Brad Carvey. He was a brother of Dana Carvey. So I knew Dana, and there was a connection there, and so developed something of a relationship with the company. Started doing this stuff, experimenting on my kitchen table up in Woodstock, and decided that I was going to make an attempt to try and do this. So I bought four more Amigas with the cards in them and started doing this project. At the time, we had no kind of relationship with sound and video. In other words, I had to go through the song that I was going to render and create a storyline at with 70 frame accurate shot lengths and things like that. And then wing it from that point on. In other words, render everything and then hope that when I got into final production and synced the sound up to the video that they would be in sync. There was no way to confirm it before the actual final part of the process, which was more than a month. And by the time we got to the end of the month, the company had come online to help me and provided me with a grand total of 30 Amigas. Each one of which had a 200 megabyte drive connected to them, which was a brick about this big. There was no such thing as networking. They all had to be sneaker netted, essentially, together. And that's probably a term that you youngsters have never even heard. But essentially, you take a drive, you fill it up, and then you disconnect and it connected to another computer and empty it into that computer. And that's how you networked. And so we had 30 drives, a couple of spares. Every time a drive got filled up, it got dumped down to a data tape storage and then recycled. And the whole process to render all of this, is a 3-minute video, took a month. Using 30 machines, And I did not find out until the last frame was rendered, and we took it into a video post-production studio to lay the sound in, that the sound actually did sync up except for one part in the very beginning. And fortunately for me, they had the technology to actually video stretch part of the video to make it fit in. But otherwise, the rest of it synced up perfectly, and the 3 months of work was not in vain. And when the company, NewTek, who provided all the equipment, saw what I had done, they founded a company with me called Newtopia, and we did experimental video with their equipment for a couple of years.
Dwayne, it's the next clip. If you flip it ahead to the next video, we're looking at the a cappella album, and I skipped past that in the presentation here, but if you get a chance, look at Change Myself online. Many of you I know have seen it, but it's still a work of art, okay. Actually. And we know that fella.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have video anymore, but if we do, I wanted to clip from 1991. Maybe we'll just throw the video out and just have a little talk and then take the questions and answers. We talked in 1991 for the first time for television, and I asked you about the next Todd Rundgren project. You just left Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You had recorded Second Wind, which was a big band album live in front of an audience, and you said, I envision the next project will be like being in a fishbowl, something you will inhabit. And I thought, you know, what the heck is he talking about? And a year or so later, you came out with something called No World Order, which was the world's first interactive CD.
Thank you so much.
And again, I think if you don't have it, look it up on the internet. It's worth checking out. But basically, it was the Philips CD-i machine. It was later available with the Apple computer.
Yeah, Philips was the one, was the entity that actually stepped up to kind of make that happen. Mm-hmm. I've been doing presentations about the potential for, but I hadn't actually done any real work in trying to present music in a different way. It was a result of a couple of realizations that I had had. One was that music was being repurposed for things other than what the original producers had in mind. Sometimes not, but often, you know, people would take a record and use it for aerobics or jogging or background music to some other, you know, to cooking, or background music for dinner, or background music for a party. In other words, music was being repurposed for things other than just sitting down and listening to it. And that was seen to be happening more and more. That was a product probably of the Walkman and the idea of the personal musical experience, which didn't exist before the Walkman. Before the Walkman, if you wanted a personal music experience, you had to just go home and put the record you wanted to listen to on and unplug the phone and whatever and listen to the music. Then the Walkman came around and you could devise your musical experience and take it with you. So people suddenly had a soundtrack to their lives, and they were purposing music, repurposing music for various aspects of their lives, when the artists were thinking, oh, people are just going to put everything else out of their mind and listen to my record, you know. And the other attendant realization that I had was that music was being repurposed in a different sense, in that it looked like new ideas were harder and harder to come by, and so it was just as legitimate to go back and revive an old idea. The biggest hit record that year was Can't Touch This by MC Hammer, which was a Rick James song, except he just wrote different lyrics over it, and it became a bigger hit than the original song was. And there was Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which was not as big a phenomenon here, but I was paying attention to what was going on in England. And every 2 weeks, they'd release a new remix of the same song. Relax, there was 20 versions of Relax that came out. And every single one of them went to the top of the charts in England. All right. And I started again in some others. I got into this, actually it's a production entity. Their videos and everything made it look like a band, but they never performed live, they never did anything. They were called the KLF. And they did the same thing, where they did this 3 a.m. Eternal thing, and there were so many different mixes of it, you know, but it, they all had like a slightly different atmosphere, they were all different lengths, you know. Suddenly music was a plastic thing, you know, it wasn't always the same way every time.
And let me jump in there, because one of the offshoots of this was you went to Time Warner, or maybe you were called in by Time Warner, at a certain point, and you had this idea that maybe...
Oh, this is after that.
Yeah,
this is the... Well, we, you know, the third leg, I guess, of the stool was the technology had evolved to the point that you could actually control music in real time. There were music compression technologies, so we could put music on a disc, you could play part of it while you're accessing another part of it, so that you could put chunks of music together in random orders without any sort of apparent interruption in between. But we developed a whole sort of system by which people could describe the kind of music that they wanted, even in very abstract terms, and have the system go out and find the fragments, put them together, and play them for you. Warner Full Service Network was an enterprise that was trying to, was conducting an experiment in Orlando, Florida, in a suburb of Orlando, to find out what the demands for desire was for on-demand television services. They wanted to create a fully interactive TV neighborhood. And they had fiber optic to the curb everywhere, and I don't know what it was from the curb of the house, but they had SGI develop a special box, which was an SGI, it was called an Aqua, I think, or something like that, or an Indigo. And it was a box about this big and about that big and about that thick, and it weighed like 40 pounds. And it sat on top of the TV. They figured, oh, we're going to get this down the right size eventually, you know, but they had this whole freaking, you know, one of the world's, you know, most expensive graphics computers was the box. And they had like applications like design your own pizza, you know, before the pizza gets delivered. But the purpose of the whole thing was to find out what sort of demand there was, you know, for these kinds of services. And they wanted me to design a on-demand music service that would allow people to do what you could do on No World Order. In other words, say, okay, there's the mood I'm in. Just pick music that supports that mood. Or here's the event that I'm at. It's a dance party and I want dance music, or I want soothing dinner music, or whatever. You know, that you would be able to just, you know, set some criteria and have music piped to you from a server. But obviously to do that, you got to get music on a server. And there were servers, but there was no music on any server anywhere. This was before Napster as well. And we had to go to the major labels and try and get, for experimental purposes only, you understand, the rights to put music on servers so that it could be delivered into people's homes. And I think there were five or six major labels then, and a lot of the, you know, the major labels would distribute a lot of labels that could appear to be independent but actually depended on that distribution, and tried to get the rights to put just a handful of your artists, or one, any of them, you know, let's put them on the server so we can see whether people actually want to do this. And not a single label would even consider it. They were so worried about bootlegging, for starters. You know, the only thing they were ever focused on is bootlegging. And it's saying, this is completely ephemeral. It isn't discs or anything. You know, it's people listening in their homes. And even Warner Brothers, this is the Warner Brothers Full Service Network. Warner Brothers Records would not give us permission to put anything on a server. So whatever else happened with the rest of the service, they never did get on-demand music services.
And look at us today.
I mean, and look at where we're at today. The end result was that they refused to put their stuff on a server, refused to consider putting their stuff on a server, and within like 3 years, Napster is eating their lunch. And they are so slow on, you know, picking up on this thing that to this day they haven't caught up. To this day, somebody else besides the record labels has had to take the initiative. In this case, it was probably Apple who convinced them, put your shit on a server, you know, because it's already on servers. It might as well be on a server you have some control over.
So what do you tell our music students or technology students who maybe dabble in music? How do you make a living in music going forward? How's the music industry going to look in 20 years?
Play live. You got to play live. It always was that way. Whatever it is, between the 60s and the 90s or whatever it is, when the record labels started to lose all of their mojo, that was all an illusory period from the standpoint of musicians and artists, because they thought, I got it made as long as I get signed. And of course you would get a big chunk of money, and the measure of the money was supposed to be a measure of how good you were. As opposed to a measure of the record label's estimation of how good you were. And a lot of people figured, I don't have to ever play. I just, you know, I'll wait for the dump trucks of money to pull up to my house. And that was always an illusion. You know, it's very appealing if you're lazy, but before there was ever a record industry, and long after there is whatever this stage that the record industry is going through, musicians will make their living playing music. They'll play it for people, and people will come to hear it. And the best music that will be made will be done in a live context. People will do their best to reproduce that good music in a recording context, but that's part of the challenge.
it took me a while to come to that sort of realization. As I say, I had to evolve into enough of a performer to realize that I could always do more live with the music than I could do in the studio. For one thing, I don't have an audience like exhorting me to take any chances in the studio. I've got to do it all myself. But when you perform live, it's, I mean, forgive me, but we all have that sort of morbid thing of, like, you know, the high wire act, and will they get to the other side or will they fall off? And that's why you're there. If you know they're going to get to the other side, you say, seen it, you know. It's the possibility that something's going to go horribly wrong, or it's something really unique and unprecedented and never to be repeated again is going to happen. And the idea of recording, of capturing a recording, is completely antithetical to that. You know, that's the fly in the amber. You know, the fly is never going to fly again.
Well, so, my last question before we open it up, okay. I want to get to the back to the risk-taking thing. I mean, the guy who appeared on the Midnight Special, the guy who's released records that have confused and confounded some people.
The guy who had unprotected sex. Yeah.
Well, we're not going there, Todd. Yeah. But I think you're, we won't even go there. Now he's thrown me. We live in a culture where young people at a very young age are encouraged by society to kind of find what it is in their dreams they want to do and pursue it. But usually it's something pretty rigid. And usually it's tied to making money and being successful. When we were growing up, they didn't list the top 10 movies at the box office every week. You know, the best movie at the box office was kind of a word-of-mouth thing. And now you're number one at the box office, well, mm-hmm. It's got to be a good movie. We've shifted in our thinking. So I think there'd be a lesson to our students in terms of the choices you've made. I mean, you're the guy that said, I want to go where the others won't go, you know, mm-hmm. the individualist. The courage to make those choices.
It would be really great if I could say that at one point I was completely volitional about it. But it isn't, again, it isn't rebellion per se. It's like, what do you got to lose? You know, what do you got to lose by taking the chance half the time? It's been fortunate for me that I've had the production to underwrite my lifestyle. Because that frees me when I make a record not to have to consider whether I will be required to survive off of that record. I never am. And now it's hopeless. I couldn't make a commercial record if my life depended on it. I can only make the kind of record that it occurs to me to make. And my biggest enemy is me. As I say, the thing I fear most is unconsciously writing a song that I wrote already. And then suddenly waking up, I was like, oh shit, I hope nobody notices that I just rewrote one of my own songs. You know. There is always room for something new, I think. But most people who might be the source of that new thing will give up in frustration before they get to realize it. As I say, I always had that day job to tie me through. People didn't seem to get what I wanted. It didn't much matter. At least from a career standpoint, I had another career that I was working on. So, you know, and all the musicians that I knew before I became a musician, most of them played weekends and had another job the rest of the time. Music as a career is always a long shot. It's always going to be a long shot, and the whole point of it is that worst thing that can happen is you trade your love of music along the way for the success of trying to, you know, capitalize off of the music. Only thing I want out of this is to be able to look back on what I've done and, as I say, feel like I made an attempt at the time, that I wasn't shucking, that I wasn't trying to do something because I thought I had a better idea of what somebody else wanted than what I wanted, and that I have always been willing to just let the audience be the arbiter. And if they don't respond to what I do, I'll go back to that other thing, you know, or I'll find some other thing to do. But my response to that rejection is not going to be, oh, what do you want? You know, it's a, if I can't, you know, if I can't make a living at it, I'm not going to change the way I do things in order to speculate that, you know, that I might make a living at it. Here's what I tell every act that I produce. The label wants you to come up with a single. Nobody knows what the hell a single is. A single, a hit single was something that happened. You know, you can't say something is a hit single before it happened. They may speculate it is, and they may go all their best efforts to make it be a hit single. But the problem is, if you do a song just for the sake of it being a single and you don't fully believe in it and it doesn't become a hit, there you've got that piece of crap staring you in the face for the rest of your career. You know, you did something, you know, that you didn't really feel that good about, you know, because you thought someone was going to turn it into gold, and it's still a turd, you know. And that's why I never say, you know, you don't focus on the singles. You focus on just, you know, you make the best songs you can. You know, if somebody's got something that looks like it could be, you don't do anything to sabotage it, put it that way. You suddenly don't go into some sort of, like, Lydian mode in the middle just to, you know, be cute.
And am I not mistaken, Bang the Drum All Day, you dreamt, correct?
What's that?
Did you dream Bang the Drum All Day?
I dreamt it, yeah. See, well, that's another thing that I can't say that this applies to anybody else, you know, but if I get immersed in music, how do people become, you know, these ridiculously prolific writers, be so prolific, you know, with music? It's because of the complete and total immersion in it, you know, which makes them often antisocial in all other aspects, and that's another decision you have to make, I suppose. You know, is are you so committed to music that you're willing to sacrifice other aspects of your life? And fortunately, I have an understanding family who knows that every once in a while I need to have complete and absolute solitude to cut out all the noise of everyday life so I can get some damn musical ideas to sprout up. You know, a musical commitment isn't about the success of it, you know, and it isn't about the, it's not going to make you friends just being a musician. It may make you a lot of enemies. And at the same time, I had no regrets about it. I knew early on that I was a musician. I feel fortunate that I'm making a living at it at this particular age, and I don't plan to quit, so.
Thank you. Please, if you have questions, step to the microphones in the aisles, and we'll...
Questions? Bed sores?
Anybody with questions? Don't be shy. Step up to the mic if you would. Well, there's one over there, unfortunately. There's one. Okay. Actually, if you can, just because I want to get it on tape so folks can hear it at home. Maybe you grab that one. I'm sorry, Don.
Hello.
Working.
When you were talking about the video toaster project and sort of working on the project and not knowing until the end whether it was basically, or at least one aspect was going to work, and I was kind of interested in the No World Order project and the way you had come up with the idea to structure the music so that you could flip verses around and choruses and it would still make sense musically. And you were doing that on a random access system, a hard disk at that point, right?
Yeah.
But how did you get... So to make the machine execute those, the same thing that the computer could do, did you have a proof of concept moment and like the low level stuff to make the that CDI machine, you know, move the head across the disc and know that that was going to work? Did you have a proof of concept kind of stage?
Well, I often depend on the technological expertise of others, you know, when it gets down to that level of detail. You know, you can only specialize so much. And for instance, when we were doing the No World Order project, which required us to get, you know, musical passages off of a disc
and decompressed and lined up seamlessly and stuff like that. All of that technology, another guy did that. You know, I know my limits in that particular regard, and a lot of what I do is more about the user experience and less the bottom line technology. But you know, talking about that sort of video and syncing things up, music is a much more plastic medium, as I said before, especially nowadays. The whole idea of moving parts of the song around, that to me seems almost an intrinsic part of the process now. That you arbitrarily label something a verse until you realize that it's the chorus, you know, and then you move it to a little later in the song or something like that. And I guess a point that I was kind of moving towards when I was talking about like Sig Graph and the technology then and, you know, where technology evolves. I remember it was still like 1984, 1985, and how thrilled everyone would be to see something that looked like smoke coming off a cigarette. They were just flabbergasted, you know, at the whole idea. Now you look at, you know, a production like Lord of the Rings with simulated humanoids and elephants and just like everything, you know, godzillions of pixels, and I don't know what the number with a zillion zero Googles of calculations, you know, going into these things, that the way technology has advanced, at least in this particular area, is like, it's like the discovery of electricity again. You know, it's like all of these things which we grow up with and take for granted now, but the ubiquitous communication that we have that did not exist 50 years ago. That 50 years ago, you couldn't flip open a cell phone and get so-and-so. That's the reason why I don't own a cell phone. Because I don't want anybody to get a hold of me just whenever they feel like it.
Get whatever you thought.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for coming to Greencastle.
Thank you.
So I have a question for you. With a Twist is probably one of my favorite records, not just of yours, but period. I just think that's a gorgeous album, and I really enjoy what you did to it. But my question is, do you really hate the song Hello, It's Me, given the treatment you gave it on that record?
I'm sorry, what was the end of it?
Do you really hate the song Hello, It's Me, given the treatment on that record?
Is no, I don't hate it. That wasn't an act of vengeance on the song. But that was actually maybe the fourth version that I'd done of the song. There's the original Naz version, which is kind of a dirge, but was the first time it was a hit. Then there was the version that I did on Something Anything, which was a little bit peppier and with a big band sort of arrangement. Then there was a version that I was doing live that was a little bit more kind of like a show thing, and we played it with a shuffle rhythm, and it appeared on live records. There were live versions of that, which was the third version. So by the time I got to With a Twist, first of all, I got to do something in the genre, which was bossa nova exotica, kind of, you know, a very retro thing. But also something that's different enough from the other versions, you know, that it doesn't seem like, you know, we're going back to the same well and pulling up stinky water. And the result was this sort of more Martin Denny approach, you know, something of an exotica thing. And I enjoyed doing it, and we did it live as well, and I enjoyed doing that. So it was, at least for me, nothing personal, Hello, It's Me, but if I'm required to do it exactly the way everyone remembers it, it's a definite albatross, and I ain't going there.
Lisa.
Hey, how you doing? I saw you last night in Louisville, and I noticed that you were playing a Line 6. Did you now, or have you ever been involved in modeling technologies like the Line 6 is using, or developing those sort of things?
On modeling technology?
Yeah, amp modeling.
You mean guitar amp modeling and things like that?
The Line 6 amp, as they called it, modeling, you know, the different...
Oh, yeah. Well, my recent record, Arena, I used a Line 6 export as my audio interface for the vocals as well. It's got a Phantom-powered mic plug on the back. And I almost all the guitar sounds, except under some circumstance where I wanted something and just couldn't get it, mm-hmm. are done with this Line 6 software called Gearbox. The sound is all in the computer, all modeled in the computer. And when I did use the amp, I took the direct preamp output and put it into the audio interface. And so there was never a mic in front of a guitar amplifier for the entire record. And I'm fine with that. And I've done records with, I did a Bad Religion record, you know, one of these hardcore punk bands.
Right.
And we recorded all the guitars completely dry. We didn't use any of their amps. No. We used the Line 6 modeling for all of their guitar sounds for the entire record. So the advantage of that was all you do is capture the performance but not the sound. And later you make it sound like anything you want. So the advantage of that is that you're not futzing trying to get the perfect sound. Just get a sound that's good enough, because the performance is the most important thing.
Gotcha. Oh, thanks for thanks for the shirt.
My pleasure.
Thank you. The shirt last night, the signature.
And we should point out that the vocals for Arena were done in your linen closet, right?
Well, yeah, I don't actually have a studio in Kauai. I live in Kauai, by the way. I don't actually have a studio there. We just find a space. It's pretty rural. You can find a house, a guest house somewhere, a barn, set up and record in there, make lots of noise, nobody's bothered. And in the last couple records that I've done, the best place for me to record my vocals has been in the linen closet of our Bearsville house, because it's just full of linen, you know, it's perfectly dead. But the advantage is I couldn't normally roll all the equipment in there, but since particularly the last record, I did it all on the laptop. All I have to do is, put a little keyboard stand in there with a laptop, and I'm good to go. So, please.
Well, thanks for coming tonight, Todd. I missed you at the Vogue the other night, but I've seen you a couple times, and we appreciate you always coming to the Midwest. Because,
oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, my question is, I'm a big Beatles fan, and I know throughout your career you've touched, I think you were part of Linda McCartney's photo album. She took some pictures of you in Central Park early on.
Yes.
Obviously, you produced Badfinger. Was that at the Apple Studios? And I'm just brainstorming here, so maybe you can just hit these as I go. And I know you had a little bit of back and forth with John Lennon. Did you ever meet up with Lennon after that? And when you were out on tour with Ringo, did you get a chance to ask him a lot of questions? And did you ever bump into to McCartney or Harrison on your travels?
I have met at least once all the Beatles.
Yes.
Your original question, Linda McCartney. All of those photographs were taken before Linda met Paul. As a matter of fact, she took photographs of me the day before she left England to go photograph the Beatles, and she never came back. And let me see now. Yeah, I've met all the Beatles.
And Badfinger, I think.
Badfinger, did you produce it? Was
John
it at
Lennon
Apple?
Thing, I met him briefly in L.A., and it was during John's wild years, as we say, when Yoko had thrown him out of the house.
The Lost Weekend.
The Lost Weekend.
What a revolting development. She throws him out of the house that he paid for. Then he's gallivanting around Los Angeles with Harry Nilsson, I believe, getting roaring drunk every night. And then one of the notorious incidents was him going to the Troubadour, I believe, and getting assaulting waitresses, and then putting a Kotex on his head.
Right.
And clowning around with a Kotex on his head. And I was in England, and they were interviewing me, and the English music press, like all the English press, accuracy is not really what they're about. Fair and balanced? No, I don't think so. They're looking for that one thing that they can print like this high, and get everyone like all head up. And so they were interviewing me about a bunch of stuff, but something came up about John Lennon. And I kind of, the gist of what I said, I don't remember what exactly I said, but the gist of what I said is, I don't believe it's very revolutionary to put a Kotex on your head and assault a waitress in the Troubadour. And this somehow, you know, they made a big headline about it. And then John Lennon wrote back to them, a big open letter that they published, of course. This is us doing their job for them, you know. And so he writes a big letter. He was into the Yanavian, you know, Primal Scream thing at the time, you know, which was in his Mommy Don't Go, Daddy Come Home thing, you know. So he implied that, you know, my whole thing was some sort of complaint against my father. You know, when I was talking about him being not a revolutionary role model, you know, he started imputing that I was looking at him as if he was my dad or something. And I may have had a response, but before it got too far, I actually got a phone call from him. And we realized that we were being sort of played a little bit, and we diffused the whole thing. But that was the last time I talked to him, and that was, you know, that was sort of an inconsequential conversation. So it was tempest in a teapot, as it were, just for the entertainment value of the English music press.
Did you produce Badfinger? Was it Apple Studios, or where did you record them?
No, Badfinger was done in several studios, but the one studio we didn't record in was Apple. Okay. Apple was tied up with mixing the concert for Bangladesh at the time, and that's why George Harrison had dropped out of the project. He got completely absorbed in this Bangladesh thing. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No problem.
My question is for Todd Rundgren, the producer. I'm a big fan of you as an artist. Saw you on Monday night. It was phenomenal. But now you've had the opportunity to work in Bearsville and clearly large format mixing consoles and analog tape and recording Bad Religion with Pre-Sonus and Amp Farm. And on your new record, I noticed Riff Works and Reason, these unconventional methods. Walk us through maybe the differences of recording a record in, let's say, 1972 to 2009, for starters. And is there a stock Todd Rundgren production technique when you first meet with a band and discuss production? Is it an arrangement? Is it more vibe? And maybe use like the New York Dolls' new record as an example of how you're making records today versus?
My standard procedure is that before we even decide to take on a production, I get the material and evaluate the material. I don't even talk to them before that. In other words, if the song sucks, what's the point of having a conversation about it? You know, it's got a material's got to sound like it's somewhere near near final product before you go into the studio. Otherwise, go back, write some more, rehearse some more. You know, then we'll take another look at it. But if the material seems like it's, if there's enough of it that's of a quality, it seems like we can make a record, then I talk to the band. It's all free up till now, by the way. Then we talk to the band and see whether, usually the first question I ask them is, if they've had a record before, why were you dissatisfied enough with your last record that you want me to do it? You know, what are you expecting out of me? Then I, you know, I like to lay down certain ground rules. One is I don't want them rehearsing in the studio. I want them to come into the studio rehearsed. If we can't do it any other way, all right, but it's always better if the band comes in and is ready to just get right down to business and start performing the music, you know.
Do you do that pre-production? Are you in the rehearsal with them before they enter the studio?
I'm sorry.
Are you with them when they rehearse, or do you just say,
No. I don't have to be there when they rehearse. But I will make suggestions about the material, sometimes very copious. You know, I'll go through and say, you know, this verse is weak, you know, this thing. You rhyme the same word with itself. Couldn't you invest a little more thought into, you know, something like that, you know? When another word would do just as well, you know? And don't you dare try and record this song here because it blows. And I'll give them fairly, you know, detailed feedback on the material so that they can go and rehearse it that way. And it isn't required that it be perfect by the time they get to the studio, but certainly want them to be, you know, very close to being able to perform it. And the best bands are the ones who have written the material and have played it on the road first, and then come into the studio because they know what it's supposed to sound like. You know, they're not guessing. And that makes it real easy. A band like A Pursuit of Happiness, all of the stuff that we ever recorded with them, they had already played on the road for months, which meant that we did the records like start to finish a week, 10 to 10 days. And that's just taking it easy, you know, do 2-3 tracks a day, and still have most of the day left over. And you had a question about New York Dolls?
Well, just wanted to contrast, like, the way you would make a record in 1972 at Bearsville versus you recording the Dolls in Hawaii.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a lot different now than the old days. I brought them out to Hawaii so there wouldn't be any circus going on. But there are only two original members, so the whole thing is a, you know, completely rebuilt machine, I suppose. And, of course, the audience will have to be the judge, but I think it's probably, arguably, the best record they've made, if you take it out of the context of, like, it's 1977 and whatever, you know. But that's it.
I have to adjust this.
It's okay. It's actually better. I can hear you better if you're not right
you can,
on the mic.
You can hear me better. Okay.
Like echo from
you,
here.
You were talking about the idea of rebuilding machines, and you've rebuilt several. If you contrast, like, Faithfully, where you were being pretty accurate to the original, to Deface the Music, where you turned an icon on its ear, to what you have done recently with the Cars, can you talk about how you handle things that are sort of iconic in the music industry and still find life in them?
Well, you got to do it out of love, for starters. You know, you don't do it, it's not just a pointless exercise. If you're going to do a whole record of faux Beatle music, it's because you actually, you know, have some affection for the music. And it's like, I wish I'd written that. So all you do is just, you know,
turn it around,
change the stuff around, and voila, you have written it. But yeah, if you are enough of a slave in some sense. And when I was growing up, I was 14 or 15 when the Beatles first started to get on the radio. And for me, it was a whole new idea about music. Because before that, you had to be a handsome lead singer, and it was a backup band. And this was a whole new kind of... You're just one of four guys. You don't have to be the handsomest guy. You'd be Ringo. You'd be the ugliest guy, you know, in the band. And people still love you, you know. So just everything about that whole Beatles concept was appealing, you know, because it was a shortcut to ecstasy. But, yes, as you mentioned, like in Faithful, I've done other sorts of artists, the Beach Boys. But I don't think any of the other artists I desired as much to, like, have lived their musical life. Probably because of the age I was at, you know, when the Beatles came out. And the fact that that was potentially attainable for me. It would never be attainable for me to be Jimi Hendrix, for instance. I don't have the hair for it. But
is anything else going to happen with the Cars, do you think, or is that?
I don't know. The guitar is, you know, guitar refuses to die. It seems almost as though the guitar is some sort of ultimate invention, because there's been so many variations on the guitar, people trying to reinvent it. The Chapman stick, for instance, and there are a few people who play that, and it's a terrific instrument. But is it ever going to replace a guitar? No, I don't think so. You know, and I have no idea what instrument at this point took to electrification so well. You know, there's certainly electrified pianos, but they're supposed to sound like a piano. You know, the guitar, once it got electrified, went into this whole other range of sound that can only be produced by that combination of technology. So it's pretty much a high watermark. I don't know what's going to replace it.
And I think he asked in particular the Cars, the new Cars. Are they going
to? Okay, I like that answer too.
Oh,
but
okay.
What's that? Was I talking about the wrong thing?
Oh, kind of, but that's all right.
Oh,
car guitar.
He said Cars, you know. And I thought he said guitars.
Yes,
all right,
that's all right.
New Cars won't be much more of that. You know, if you do see it, it'll be because we played your corporate event. But no, we're not going to start over again. You know, trying to build a. You know, build a new audience for that. We tried it. We had our moment. The accident that Elliot suffered kind of took the air out of the balloon and just couldn't get it back in.
Okay. So, thank you.
Thanks for your question about the guitars.
I would have asked that.
I see you as a contemporary of Nanjum Paik, the sculptor, and I'm curious to know when I ask a question of a visual artist or a painter, I ask them what kind of music they like. I'm curious to know what contemporary painters or sculptors or multimedia artists you
like? Or
oh, I wish I knew enough about contemporary. You know, there. It's not that
just
I have
any painters, sculptors.
No appreciation of other art, but depends what you mean by contemporary. If you mean in the last century, I could probably.
I just wonder who some of your favorite painters or sculptors are. Anytime.
Painters and sculptors. I don't know a whole lot about sculpture. I have to say that when I was in Madrid, you know, the boulevards are lined with Botero sculptures, and they're highly amusing. I really enjoy them. For me, the most interesting all-around artist is probably Salvador Dali, in that he did sculpture, he did painting, he did decoupage, he did just about everything.
Just like you.
And did it in a way that others could only sort of imitate. And it was probably because he was sincerely crazy. But
might be a Dali of music then.
But if I have to go to see a show by one artist, I'm always more amused by a Dali show than I am by a Calder show or a de Kooning show or, God forbid, Jeff Koons.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, Ken, thanks for making this happen.
Thank you.
Thanks for showing
up.
Thank
you. Thanks, Todd.
Second of all, Todd, I've seen you many times, and I think this is the only time I've ever seen you sitting down facing the audience. So maybe once with a drum set in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
Almost always standing. Third, on the topic of risk-taking, I mean, I really see where musically you've taken a lot of risks over your career.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything comparable in your lyrics or that you've done lyrically that's risky over the years?
I've used the F word. in fact, I've used the MF word, and recently. But
your lovely wife, Michelle, is reminding us of Jesse. Which
you could say that anytime you don't write a plain old vanilla love song, you're taking some risks. You know that the challenge is always that you want to write something interesting, and there is always the possibility that someone will attach it too personally to you, and say that you literally lived this, you know, or literally did that, and if that was the standard by which you had to write all of your material, then I might run out of songs pretty quickly. But as I say, I don't think that the way I approach music is terribly different than the way I approach life in general, and I do act upon faith in a lot of instances. I am not faith-based per se. I have faith in myself, and I have faith in my ability perhaps to read a situation, but I will dare to put myself in even potentially life-threatening situations if I feel I have enough to gain out of it. In the mid-70s or late 70s, I got this idea that there was stuff in the world that I was being told about that I wanted to see for myself. So I bought an around-the-world ticket and packed a backpack, and all I did was pick the first stop, which was Istanbul. And 2 months later, I came out the other end of Asia and landed in San Francisco and went to all the places that you can't go today. So if I hadn't taken the chance of going then, I never would have seen downtown Kabul. I never would have seen Tehran. A lot of places I never just would have no authority about at all, because now they're places that you can't go. So if you have the chance, you know, you take the chance, because you may not have the chance again. Thank you.
Can I follow up real quickly? What was the takeaway from that trip? Did it influence your music? Did it influence your life?
Well, it's so easy to be glamorized about things you have no experience of. You know, you think India is a land of swamis and magic. No, it's a land of abject poverty and craziness. And, you know, there are some incredibly wonderful things that you never realized were there. And there's incredibly horrible things that you never realized were there. And if you just read all of your, you know, Krishnamurti and stuff like that, you know, you think that India has, you know, got a mystic on every corner. And it isn't like that. You know, it's a country that is struggling to catch up to the rest of the world, sometimes doing it in a really loutish way, full of internal strife and religious inter-cult conflicts and things like that, and still it's a place worth going to and seeing. But you can't go with specific expectations. They will not be met. They will be substituted with something else.
I'm a big fan, been a big fan for many, many, many years. Not to date you or me, but it's been enjoyable over the years to listen to all the music experiments you've had. With technology that's kind of exploded, especially with music, there's opening fields within music that are not necessarily musician mm-hmm. connected. It's more programmer. His ideas come from the way he programs, not so much how he plays. Do you think that all that technology has somehow drawn people into the arena that really are not true musician and not really held up the musicianship that people would probably go to if it wasn't so much choice? Or mm-hmm. do you think it's actually drawn people into it and actually created better musicians at some other point in time, including yourself?
Well, all of the accoutrements to making recordings and stuff like that, they're all neutral, of course. They don't do anything until somebody brings a sensibility to them and starts using them for good or evil, as the case may be. Your point about how it impacts musicianship. Again, there is that distinction between a performer and a musician, and there are people whose only desire is to pick up enough musicianship in order to be a performer, like Madonna or something like that. She's not interested in being the world's best singer, world's best songwriter, world's best anything. She's interested in being Madonna, and she only needs enough music so that she can justify charging you money to come see her perform it. Is it possible for the technology to compromise people's musical sensibility? It is possible, but it's only one thing that can compromise the sensibility. The bigger problem is that people writing music when they don't have anything to write about. Music that means anything to people comes from some place of meaning. It comes from you having something you desperately desire to communicate or externalize, and music is your medium. And if you do it in a way that not only uses the medium but can in some ways transcend the obstacles that the medium presents, then your meaning will be conveyed to other people. And musicianship, how sophisticated a musician was Robert Johnson, and yet he founded probably all of the music that we are listening to today, in some sense. We don't listen to a lot of classical music. We listen to some music that came out of the blues. It's either rock and roll or R&B or dance music of some kind, something that came from a guy who never went to music school and never learned to play anything but a handful of chords on his guitar and never sang about anything but sex.
Sure. The gut emotions. He was expressing gut emotions, yeah. So a loop master would not be necessarily a musician in the same sense mm-hmm. as somebody playing an instrument, but there might be a talent for that somewhere.
If only, maybe the record industry would be healthier, I don't think there's some things that there isn't supposed to be a science for. That's what makes them valuable, that the only way you get them is through, extreme human effort or experience or some things like that. If gold nuggets were laying on the ground, gold would be worth nothing. It's that you got to dig a big hole to go get it, and that's why it's worth something. So effort counts, I think.
We just got a couple more minutes.
Thanks.
Thank you for your question. So we'll get through these, and
hi.
Thank you, Todd.
First of all, I want to thank you for never selling out and always being interesting. And second of all, I want to thank you for the spiritualism you sprinkle into your different albums. I remember when I was my son's age, and I heard the wheel, I heard, karma, what's that word? I have to go look that up.
How about onomatopoeia? Look that up.
No, I knew what that word meant by the time Hermit came out. And that's a great song. That was my ex-husband's favorite for a long time. Also, I quit smoking 6 months ago, and for some reason, whenever I had a real bad craving, I put on Just One Victory, craving gone. And I wanted to ask you, Daryl Hall's doing this live at Daryl Hall's house thing once a month, and he has these different guests. He's had, you know, the younger musicians. He's had Nick Lowe, and he has a really good band behind him. And I wonder if he ever asked you to perform on that monthly thing. It's live on the net. Would you ever consider doing it? Because I enjoyed you when you played with Daryl Hall and John Oates.
I'm open to almost anything. Usually, you know, Daryl and I have been out together. Of course, mm-hmm. Holland, Oates, and me. They're still in Oates.
Yeah, they're still in Oates, but he's not on that show usually.
But I'm not exactly sure I understand the implication of the question.
He's got like an online TV show.
Yeah.
He makes a mean martini, I'm told.
Did she set you up to this?
No, it's a great, I'm telling you, the band is great. And the people
I know.
It's a,
I've heard about this, but I'm, you know, when I hear about him having success with that, I think, yeah, it'd be interesting to do that. What can I do that's like that? You know.
Well, yeah,
there are the challenges of. I've always thought that the hardest thing that I've ever done was music for television, because there's no flexibility in it. And you're the low man on the totem pole, and you get the, you know, you get the notes and everything after everyone else is done, and your thing gets applied last in the production, and they do arbitrary things with it, anything they wanted. But the hardest part for me was the fact that you have to write and record anywhere from 10 to 30 to 40 minutes worth of music in something like 3 days. And I've tried to do things where I've had, you know, actual sort of time-based commitments, you know, where, okay, I got to do this by the end of the month, and I'm going to do this every month, stuff like that. When it gets to doing something like every week, or worse, every day, I can't imagine how they, you know, I can't imagine, I can understand why, put it this way, David Letterman is in such a bad mood all the time.
That's what I hear.
He's freaking trapped by this job, you know? He's like trapped in it. And the problem with something like that is the success of it locks you into something that perhaps you didn't expect, you know? And while I can imagine, you know, like doing an episode or something like that, it's a far greater challenge, you know, obviously for him or for anyone who wants to do something like that, to do something that is, you know, you got to find good guests at regular intervals. You have to do good shows all the time in that particular kind of format and things like that. So I'd be happy to appear on somebody's show like that, but I'd have to think long and hard before doing something like that.
That I can understand.
Myself.
You've always got so many different things in your mind. And where do you go next from here? I know you mentioned a Robert Johnson project that you were thinking about doing?
I'm going to rest for a little while.
That's cool,
after this
too.
Tour is done. But not for long. I got a little more playing to do. I always have, you know, a little bucket list of things.
Bucket list.
Of things that I like to do, you know, in the short term. And it's all a question of things falling into place and time and stuff like that. I can say that on my plate are various things like possibly some kind of computer game, involvement in that somehow. Possibly some sort of record production, stuff like that. There'll be other things besides playing live and producing records that I'll have the opportunity to do, I'm sure. But
any sort of musical in the future?
We need to get on to the other questions because we're running out of time. I'm sorry, but... I just worry that we're going to run out of time here.
Okay.
Hello.
In an article I once read, you said that you could...
It's completely made up. It's not coming from anyone's heart. It's just meant to be clever and facile and stuff like that, and that kind of music doesn't appeal to me. It doesn't mean that all country music and every country artist sucks. There is great country music, but unfortunately, what gets played on the radio is like what gets played on the radio of everything else, you know, which is usually not the best of it. Just the most accessible of it, you know. And I have a feeling that if I tried to do that, you know, that real country listeners would sense in me the fact that I was not actually being concertedly fake enough or whatever, I don't know, and just would realize that I wasn't being sincere with it, you know. And I never thought I would do a arena rock record, but once I did it, you know, I have a lot of fun doing it. And I imagine if I ever figure out a way that I want to do country music or death metal or any other kind of, you know, extreme genre, that I would figure out a way to do it so that I would at least have fun doing it. And so you're right, you should never say never, especially as a musician. But I don't know when I will do that. I don't have an idea at this point.
We've got time for two more questions, because okay, these gentlemen have been in line, and thank you very much.
Yeah, great to see you here in the Midwest, and thanks for being
thank
a
you
part of the tour.
Good shirt.
I know. Nice time at your house. So.
Todd Stocker.
He signed my accordion, too, so I didn't bring that with me tonight, but it's around. I guess the question was, I heard you talking about kind of that period of time when you were excited about the computer graphics and the inception of the graphic tablets and some of the first things that were emerging then, and of course we've come a long way since then. I'm curious if there's anything on your bucket list or other technologies that are kind of at the fringes or just emerging that you see yourself taking advantage of. I've been spending a lot of time like with visualization, real-time visualization software and things of that nature that I think have a lot of concepts that you were probably one of the first to really exploit without the hardware.
Well, it's funny, I'm very selective about the technologies I get involved in and when I get involved in them. As I say, I didn't think I wanted to use computers to make music for a long time while other people were doing it, or using sequencers or other sorts of digital things, you know, to produce music. For a long time, I thought I have no interest in that. And then I sort of got to a point where I thought this, you know, and it was around No World Order. I said, before that, I was doing all live records. I said, I don't want any kind of artifice. I want all live players playing in real time. But to do this kind of concept of random access music, everything had to be so precise that the only practical technology was, you know, using sequencers and, you know, various kind of computer-based music production tools. And it's just turned out to be a convenience for me maybe since then that I continue to use them. Doesn't mean it's exclusive, but I'm comfortable with the technology now. But for instance, I don't own a cell phone. I don't tweet, I don't blog. I don't, you know, I think the automobile was one of the biggest mistakes humankind has ever made. And I would love to see some way to ameliorate that. I'm getting to the point now where I want certain technologies to disappear, as opposed to the new ones to appear. And maybe that's just me becoming old and crotchety. But when I imagine the future, I don't imagine immediate boons from these things. The reason why I don't own a cell phone, and the reason why I don't tweet, and the reason why I don't blog, you know, have nothing to do with the technologies. It has to do with the kind of behaviors that it elicits in other human beings that I just don't want to have anything to do with. Some anonymous clown, you know, who will say things he would never say to your face just because he's got a keyboard and a remote connection. So there are some technologies I wish would become less popular. Cell phones are just out of hand at this point. The freaking messaging and tweeting. Is everything we have to say that important? Just everybody's... It's essentially gotten to the point where people put no value on listening. They put all the value on talking and no value on listening. And I, you know, I'm not going that way. You know, I'm a musician. I need people to listen, you know.
So. Final question of the night is from Tim Brickley, Indianapolis musician.
Yeah, Todd, this has been a blast. I know, lifelong inspiration for me, and I'm sure everybody here. So
Thank you.
And Ken, good job putting this together. I was just wondering, could I produce your next record? It's a joke. although, not really. I know what you should do. Now, a little from Peter, Paul, and Mary to Bob Dylan to you, Albert Grossman, I thought, has always been an amazing figure. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about him, and who do you think he'd be working with today?
He was a funny guy, Albert Grossman, and today nobody would work with him if he continued on the path that he had been on. Albert Grossman was originally a restaurateur in Chicago, And he was one of the first people to like build a little stage and have folk acts come in and play at his restaurant. And those folk acts turned out to be Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary and other seminal folk acts that he later signed and evolved from being a restaurateur into a super manager. And when I was with him, he was still managing Peter, Paul, and Mary. He wasn't managing Bob Dylan anymore, but he had Janis Joplin, and he had James Cotton. He had the band. It still had a fairly substantial raft of artists, many of which I got to work with. But he was still a restaurateur at heart, and a real. If you got to know Albert, you inevitably had a love-hate relationship with him. If you didn't get to know Albert, you had a hate relationship with him. But if you did get to know him, then you had a love-hate relationship. He could be very generous at times. He could do great things for your career. He could be the biggest jerk in the world. And he would screw you just as look at you, no matter how long you had worked with him. And he did that to me. And when he died, I had no regrets, and few people did. He was one of these larger-than-life things, but in the end, he had no true friends, because he everything in his world had a little Dymo label on the bottom with the insurance number on it. Everything, every single thing, salt shakers, had a little Dymo label on the bottom with insurance number on it, you know. He cared so much about the things that he had, you know, and the things he could acquire, and so little about the impact all that had on the people that he lived with and worked with. So he was an extremely powerful and interesting guy and extremely flawed guy. So,
well, Todd, you have had an enormous impact on all of us, a positive impact, and thank you for your contributions to the world, to music, to DePaul University tonight. And I'm going to shake your hand, and I've got a gift for you. Before we all say goodnight, I have a DePaul sweatshirt for you. And I got one for Michelle, too, that she's going to get.
Can I get an honorary degree? I never did go to
college. Yeah, we got one of those in the back.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Todd Rundgren.
Yes, DePaul. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I have to pee.